I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. We are talking about artisan and farmstead cheeses on the show today. The Philadelphia area has been experiencing a cheese renaissance in recent years, sparked by the farm-to-table movement, consumers more discriminating and demanding palates, rich soil, and an abundance of dairy farms. And that's created the right environment for homemade, handmade, and specialty cheeses. Our guests came to cheesemaking through different routes. Sue Miller was a struggling dairy farmer looking for a more stable source of income and is co-owner of Bertrand Hills Farm in Chester County. Stephanie Angsa was working at a bank in New York when she bought a cheesemaking kit and now owns Valley Milk House in Berks County. They have generously brought in some of their cheeses for us to sample, and I must say, I do love my job. Also with us is Tania Darlington, and she blogs as Madame Fromage and is the author of several books, including De Bruno Brothers' House of Cheese. Tania, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Sue, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And Stephanie, thanks for rounding out our trio of cheese people here. Thanks
thank
for coming
so
in, especially from Berks County. So we're in a cheese renaissance. Sue, why do you think that is?
Well, listen, we are within 30 miles of the greatest market on the East Coast, you know, with New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. And as a dairy farmer selling on the commodity milk market, you know, you can be lost because we can't capture the efficiencies of larger farmers, larger dairy farms out in the Midwest or the Western states. So what were we going to do? We wanted to stay here and make cheese. So I think cheese is a natural progression for those of us who understand the benefits of the market being so close by.
And I wonder whether 20 years ago you would have said to yourself, you know, artisanal cheese, that's the way we're going to support our dairy farm.
Right. It's a whole new world
for us.
It's a
whole new world. Tell us your story, Stephanie, about how you were working in New York.
Yeah, I was working in New York. I had a liberal arts degree from college and kind of migrated to New York with all my friends and got a job with BNY Mellon as a sales associate. And after a few years, I was pretty sure it wasn't for me. I was interested in home cheese making because I grew up with a Belgian mother and at a young age cultivated a love for strong, stinky cheese.
Don't we all?
And so I dabbled in home cheese making until I decided I liked it enough to quit my day job and go apprentice with a goat dairy out in Colorado.
And eventually ended up in Berks County, not far from where some of your ancestors had farms.
Yeah.
I mean, how unusual is that?
Yeah, it was a pretty serendipitous occasion where I met someone farming in that area where my ancestors are from and not far from where my father and his family grew up. And I knew I wanted to be on the East Coast, and I felt that that spot was as good as any to settle down. And when I did, I truly fell in love with it and feels like it's always been home for me.
I want to pick up on all of that. Tania, let me get you in on the conversation. You're not a cheese maker, but you're Madame Fromage, a cheese lover for sure.
I'm a longtime cheese lover. Like Stephanie, my mother is European. She's from Switzerland, and I grew up in the Midwest where we were always hunting for like the stinkiest Gruyères and Appenzellers on the weekend to, you know, sate her palate. So I have a writing background. I love food. I love words. And when I started getting into the lexicon surrounding cheese, it all came together.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I was thinking last night, putting together my questions, there is a lexicon that comes with wines, right?
True.
All those adjectives.
Absolutely.
How do we speak cheese?
How do you speak cheese? Well, you know, we've been letting your cheese relax, Marty. You know, relaxation.
Which is sitting right here next to me.
It's a key point. When you put out cheese for people to enjoy, you want to let it relax. You want to let it come to room temperature, let it lounge for 45 minutes to an hour. But there are all kinds of great words, especially in terms of describing cheese flavors. So you might have an aged Gouda with a little pineapple on the finish. You might taste a little bit of bourbon in a cheddar. You get grassy notes, hay notes. You're going to taste that in some of Steph's fresh cheeses that she brought in for today. So I love those kinds of words that people use to describe cheese, so tasting notes, but also then just words like rennet, words like cave.
Coagulate.
Ferment.
Ferment. Well, let me pick up on cave. We're learning a lot about cheese making on the show today. And I'm looking at you, Sue. So at your farm, and you have your own cows.
Yes.
So what do you feed your cows?
So our cows are out on pasture 24 hours a day. They have a choice to be in the barn or out on pasture. So they're grazing, but we also supplement their feed. So they're getting some dry hay, a small amount of corn silage. We really are concerned with them having a balanced diet that keeps them healthy and productive as well, because we need them to produce a certain amount of milk so that we can, for the economics of it. So really, it's important to us for them to be outside on mm-hmm. that grass, having that grass-based system, but we do supplement their feed as well. And it is all about the well-being of the cow for us.
A happy cow. I think right. I saw a quote somewhere. Mm-hmm. So what kind of cheeses do you find you can make best?
Well, we like to make a small array of cheeses that sort of express our milk and express our personality, the personality of our farm. So we kind of like lean on the maybe the funky side of life in the cheese world. We have a wash dry little stinker that we make called Red Cat that's beloved here in the city. We also make sort of the big brother to that cheese called Fat Cat. It's earthy and grassy and unusual, but yet really familiar to folks. So people seek that cheese out. We're probably most known for our blue cheese called Birch Run Blue, and that is the first cheese we decided to make and gave me every single gray hair I have on my head.
Really?
It's like a It's a wild teenager, and Steph can talk about this too because we share some conversations about the naughtiness of blue cheese sometimes.
Another good word, right?
Right. You know, so I kind of like, we just try to produce good, clean, honest milk and make good, honest cheeses with it that we love to eat and hope other people do too.
That you love to eat. Stephanie, let me get to you because you don't have cows, but you've got, I guess, neighbors with cows or goats or sheep or whatever you use.
Yeah, that's right. I'm unusual. We are unusual as a creamery in this state as being a non-farmstead creamery because Pennsylvania having such a strong agricultural and dairy heritage, that's where a lot of cheesemakers have their background, like Sue Miller's story is very common within our state. And so my approach coming at it from just a love of cheese and sort of the finished product is unique. And I think there are drawbacks and there are benefits. It's nice that I can buy milk from these two dairy partners that we work with, as much as we need or as little as we need. It's allowed us to grow a lot quicker than we thought we could. But there is a sort of severed connection to the farm and the land. And so
Without
the cows, because cheese making is the most dynamic process. And I think a lot of us are drawn to it because it is so tied to the land. So the milk is different every day, every week, every month, and it's really important to be connected to what's happening on the farm.
Use your hands to make cheese?
Oh, yes.
Is it like kneading dough?
It's interesting. I mean, cheese making is a very sensual experience, and I think that's one of the things I was drawn to about it as well. You use all your senses. You know, scent is so important. We stir curds by hand, and we shape cheese by hand, and we salt by hand. And so much of that experience informs our process.
I mean, just so, literally the feeling of it?
Yes, absolutely.
So a very tactile experience, Tanaya.
Oh, it is. I've watched both of these two make cheese, and it's a beautiful thing. When Sue was the very first cheesemaker I met in this area. I moved here from Wisconsin in 2005, and I did a story on her for Culture Magazine, a cheese magazine, and I went out to her creamery, and she, for, you know, like 40 minutes, she was stirring this curd with this beautiful paddle, and she was like, oh, this is like how I get my solitude, and I just think of like I'm rowing a boat, and she was wearing a red kerchief and she had on her red gloves, and it was like watching a gondolier in Venice,
yes, right.
You know, with dreaminess in her eyes. So it's really a beautiful thing, and that the make room always smells good. It smells sort of like being in almost like a bakery with like yeasty smells, like the warm milk. You just want to go to bed.
Interesting. Well, I had to remember curds and whey. I mean, it had been a little while since I thought of Little Miss Duffet, but we're talking curds and whey, yes?
That's right. The curds and whey. It's such a big part of that process. Once we bring that milk in, and for us, we are milking the cows on the morning of cheese making, and transporting that milk to our vat within an hour from when the cows have been milked. It's in the vat, and we start the process. And here in the United States, we add cultures to the milk, and the cultures are the beneficial bacteria that are present in the milk anyway. But because we have such high standards of cleanliness, we actually have to boost those cultures in the milk.
Really?
Yeah. So we're adding cultures in, we're giving it a ripening time, letting the cultures come to life and really get invested in the milk and start to become really active and do their job. After that ripening period, then we set the milk with the rennet. That's a coagulant, and it sets it up like yogurt. And after a period of time, that's when we get to cut the curds and whey. So getting to your whey, getting to your whey process. And for us, we take that whey home and feed it to our pigs.
Oh, interesting. So. It looks like you wanted to say something, Stephanie.
Yeah, well, that's and what Sue's describing is sort of that first phase of cheese making. That gives you a fresh wheel of cheese. But that's only, you know, day one of the life of this cheese. And then beyond that, it gets salted and it cures for a period of time. And then it gets moved to a ripening environment, which is, you know, damp. It's humid and it's lukewarm. If you think of a root cellar or, you know, a cave.
Your grandmother's
basement. Yeah, but it smells a lot nicer.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, the controlled decay starts to begin. That's what's so fascinating about it, is that those cultures that Sue talked about that we're adding in step one are now starting to die off and release enzymes and sort of nurturing this, you know, next phase of enzymatic activity, which leads to flavor and texture and all these wonderful goopy, you know, oozy, decadent flavors and nice aromas that we love.
Well, it is really, Tanaya, then, I mean, it is art and science, as we just, you know, got a little science lesson here.
It absolutely is. I mean, I'm just sitting here listening to these two talk, and it's bliss, is it not, Marty?
Especially with a big pile of cheese and some crackers sitting next to me here.
It's so aromatic in here. It's like we brought a little piece of the farm.
Yeah. It's easy to make friends when you have cheese. We always have it in our hip pocket, don't we, Steph?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but I'm just a quick question to you, Stephanie. If you're a cheesemaker, can you take a vacation, or are you constantly in some process of making cheese?
It's definitely a full-time plus job. You know, it's a minimum of 80 hours a week.
Is it really?
In full season. Now, Sue can tell you more about not being able to take a vacation because she has cows to milk twice a day. And whereas I can take January and February off to catch up on, you know, business work. But it can be as full-time job, absolutely. And, you know, we're talking about it so blissfully, and I think we all still feel very romantic about our livelihoods. But that's not to say that it's also a struggle every day. So we can get to that, too.
We will get to all of that, and we're going to get to some eating some cheese as well. And, yes, we are talking about cheese on Radio Times today. That's Stephanie Ungstadt, also Tanaya Darlington, and Sue Miller, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me reintroduce our three guests. Tanaya Darlington blogs about cheese in Philadelphia as Madame Fromage, wrote a book called De Bruno Brothers, House of Cheese, and she's got a new one called The New Cocktail Hour. She directs the Writing Studies MA program at St. Joseph's University. Stephanie Ungstadt is owner and cheesemaker of Valley Milk House. That's an artisan creamery that makes fresh and aged cheeses, butter, yogurt in Berks County, just outside of Philadelphia. And Sue Miller, owner and cheesemaker of Bertrand Hills Farm. That's a family-owned dairy farm in Chester County, Pennsylvania. And the Millers offer handcrafted raw milk cheese. 1-888-477-9499. The phone number to join our conversation. All right, I'm going to rip open some crackers here because the cheese is really giving off a very nice aroma. That's for our sound effects team here. Rip it with my teeth, of course. So we have some cheese sitting across from me.
Can I pass it over to
you? You can pass it
over
to me. All right.
We've created a dream bite for you.
Oh, my gosh.
With those Effie's corn cakes, some fresh cheese and a little bit of Meyer lemon jam if you want to try trio together. The jam comes from a fabulous blogger in town who we do some events with named Marisa McClellan of Food in Jars.
Oh, that's great. So on my left, what am I looking at here on my left? This is so unfair to our listeners. I just have to say that I understand why you're mad at me. What am I looking at here on my left?
Okay, on your left,
this
Marty,
is Stephanie talking.
Yes, you're looking at the fromage blanc, and we call that one clover. And it is a fresh cow's milk cheese that is a little tart and very creamy. And that's a cheese that we make. It's a very slow fermentation, so it takes 16 hours of ripening in the vat to develop good acidity. And a little tiny bit of rennet is what ends up curdling it.
Should I put a little bit of this on top?
Uh-oh, what do you
think?
Should.
Yes,
I think it's like the first.
All right.
It's the most delicious bite of the day, Marty.
All right, here we go. Oh, wow. That's really good. Wow. It's so smooth.
Yes, it's a very
mouthful.
Luscious, velvety texture, indeed. Yes, that one is a really nice blank canvas too. Even though it has enough character to stand on its own, chefs really love that. They, you can crumble it onto a salad or mix it into an omelet. It makes a great sauce. It's a nice ingredient cheese as well.
Do you work with a lot of chefs, Stephanie?
Yeah. Sue and I both do, if I could speak for her. When I first started the production 2 years ago, I didn't think that wholesale would be a very big part of the business initially because I was certain that I needed to develop a little bit more experience. But Philadelphia has such an insatiable appetite for cheese that I was happily wrong. And got a lot of phone calls. And Sue Miller was really the first person. This is just to demonstrate how collaborative the cheese industry is in Pennsylvania. I call Sue the mother of Pennsylvania cheese because she takes every new...
She just rolls her eyes.
I'm the oldest.
She takes every new person under her wing. And that's nice. I got some of the first wholesale buyers through her.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah,
very nice.
I almost texted you, say, are you ready for this?
It's coming, right?
Are you ready for this? I Instagrammed you. Yeah. And
she sent me photos. She was like, tonight you're not going to believe it. There's this like 29-year-old woman who's producing the most phenomenal French-style cheeses.
So she's got the touch.
Yeah.
We're all on direct dial.
You didn't hear that.
You also made some butter, right, Stephanie?
Yes.
We have what I'm about to eat now?
Yes. Oh, so that's cultured butter. You can see it's a beautiful golden yellow color.
Yeah, different from the supermarket.
Yeah, that's from grass-fed Jersey cow. Wow. The cream comes from Seven Stars Farm, which is also a lovely dairy near Sue. And the butter is cultured. A lot of people ask, what is cultured butter?
Yeah, right.
That means that we ripen the cream first before we churn it. And so it just develops a bit of a richer flavor. It's essentially fermented cream.
Are you using a hand butter churn?
Everyone has a nice romantic visual of me in a bonnet, but that's actually not over a wooden churn, but we use a mechanical churn.
Wow, that's good. I'm going to share.
Sure.
Can I share?
Send it on over.
That's fabulous. We are talking about cheese. We are eating about cheese as well. And I got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me just, a tweet from Bill. He said, why don't people make cheese from pig milk? I'm looking at Sue for an answer to that.
First of all, have you ever tried to milk a pig? You know, I think we should save the pig's milk for the baby piglets, you know. I think it's easy. You know, there are other animals that are ruminants that we can harvest the milk from to create these beautiful cheeses. And I think we ought to utilize it, whether it's cow's milk, goat's milk, sheep's milk, buffalo. We have a buffalo milk producer in North Jersey. One of our friends who's a cheesemaker here in Philadelphia is an urban cheesemaker and travels up there to assist them. So we have this rich history of cheesemaking with the ruminants.
I'm curious, too, for tonight, for people listening, about some of the sort of basics of, I mean, you all, I'm sure, can answer this, but storing cheese, of how long cheese lasts. I mean, it's been sitting out for a little bit, so I'm getting some nice aroma here. But some of the do's and don'ts, and even some of the pairings.
Oh, sure. Well, I always recommend cuddling up to a cheesemonger to get into the cheese scene, by which I mean...
And monger is seller.
A cheesemonger is a cheese seller. Rather than, say, buying shrink-wrapped cheese. Because when you buy cheese that's fresh cut off the wheel, as the cheeses that we've brought in are today, you are getting them at just like the peak quality. So that's one do.
Right.
Befriend a cheesemonger and buy cheese right off the wheel. Ask questions. Build relationships. Those are two big things. So I got to know about Pennsylvania cheesemakers by simply going to all the farmers markets and looking for the cheese people. Huh. Also, you know, when I moved here from Wisconsin, I walked right into the 9th Street De Bruno Brothers, which has over 300 different cheeses. And I simply asked for a cheese that was familiar to me. And the monger behind the counter said, well, if you like that, let me show you this. And it was being exposed and having that conversation that made me think, this is several weeks later, I'm going to eat every cheese in this case, you know, because I just wanted to experience it all.
So, and did you?
I did, and that's how the blog began and the book came about. I decided to eat my way through the entire De Bruno Brothers stock. So I literally went from being a customer to kind of a collaborator. And the other thing is to go to cheese shops at off-peak hours, like Tuesday at 10 a.m. is
Why?
A great time to visit a cheese shop because it's not busy and the people behind the counter are coming in fresh. They've probably been snacking. They know exactly what's ripe. The case looks gorgeous. You can take some great photos. But also because it's not busy, they're there to dote on you. And so I would go in for these little cheese lessons. I'd be there for 60 minutes, 90 minutes. Someone else would walk in. You know, they'd get in on it too. And again, that's like having the conversation, building relationship, growing knowledge. The other thing I always recommend is when you go in to buy cheese, know what you're going to serve it with or tell the monger, hey, I really love dark beer, or tonight I'm having a Sauvignon Blanc, or tonight I want a barbecue. I want something that's not going to sweat sitting outside. You know, those little cues can really help someone guide you to finding the cheese of your dreams. That's what it's all about.
Sue, anything or Stephanie, anything you want to add to that?
I just have to agree. Cheesemakers and cheesemongers, we're like librarians. You should come ask us questions, don't you think, Steph? We want to engage with our eaters, our consumers. So stop by the market and see us, or stop in at De Bruno's or Tallulah's Daily or Fair Food. There's some really great places with some great people behind the counter who will absolutely, if you're lost in the cheese world, they will help you with a map.
Yeah.
They will help you.
And I've been intimidated. I've been on the other side of the cheese counter where I've been intimidated. I think a really good starting point is to just ask open-ended questions. Like, what are we looking at here? Tell me about what you produce. Or, I don't know, but I think I like strong cheeses. And that's just a starting point. You know, it's all about exploration.
And you get a little sampled and see if you like it or not.
Absolutely.
Let me just reintroduce the three of you. That's Stephanie Ungstadt, also with us, Tania Darlington, and Sue Miller. And we are talking about cheese. They are feeding me cheese and taking calls as well. And we've got some comments as well. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We wanted to do this show because there is a kind of a cheese renaissance going on here in the Philadelphia area, certainly other parts of the country as well, but something that we are enjoying if you live in the Philly area. Let me get Jim from Wilmington to join us. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My mother was from Wisconsin, so I was used to there being a lot of good eating up there, including good cheeses, the great summer sausage and brats and everything. Mm. But the main thing is I was watching a show about cheese. I think it was on one of the public stations. It was one of those Globe Trekker shows, and they were doing a show about cheese. And I got the impression that some of the people who were kind of guiding the people around there and showing them all this stuff were sort of putting up their noses at American cheeses, and I got the impression that it was because they didn't use raw milk, and I was, you know, every time if you most places, of course, the big producers, you know, the agribusiness kind of producers are naturally going to probably not do that, but so maybe you can talk
sure.
a little more about what it takes for that to happen.
Well, in fact, Sue, you use raw milk, so you can answer Jim's question.
Yeah, we do use raw milk, and I think what's happening with this renaissance is all across the country, small producers are beginning to embrace European traditions. And of course, in Wisconsin and Vermont, they've been leading the way. Wisconsin has such a strong history of artisanal cheesemaking, and Vermont is definitely a good 10, 15 years ahead of Pennsylvania. And thank goodness we have our friends to the north to kind of help us show us the way of creating these beautiful cheeses out of the fresh milk from the state. Because after all, Pennsylvania leads the country. We're the fifth largest dairy producer here in the United States. But I think what happens is where people kind of turn their nose up is with the Velveetas of the world, the commodity cheeses, the ones that can be created maybe out of milk. I don't even know. I'm jesting there. But you know, I think for a long period of time that American cheeses were not taken seriously. But really here in the last year, there are some producers in the United States who are exporting their product to France. Rogue Creamery and the Pacific Northwest is doing it. I believe Jasper Hill may be working on that. So European counterparts are starting to take the United States seriously. And one of the ways I really know that's happening is because we've had three large cheesemakers who are artisanal cheesemakers in California sell their company to a Swiss company. And that tells me that the Swiss see the United States as a new frontier. They see that there is a great market to be gained here as we as Americans grow up in our tasting ability. And I'm telling you, we have loyal followings at the farmers market, people who stop in just for a little bite.
And
it opens this whole experience for them. And it's really empowering to us as producers to be able to connect with people that way.
Well, speaking of tasting, I'd like to taste some more cheese. One thing I would say, cheese is not cheap, but I think we perhaps think of big chunks of cheese and downing that. It's the little things, right, Stephanie? It's like a little slather of cheese on a cracker.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think a little bit goes a long way. And especially with some of these richer, stronger, and complex flavors that you're seeing in artisan cheese in the U.S., you don't need very much to feel complete satisfaction and to feel full and gratified from the experience. So, indeed, a little bit goes a long way.
So, Sue, I'm going to try this. Is this your blue?
Yes. Yeah, that's the Bertrand blue.
The one that's turned your hair a certain color.
It's a wild child.
A wild child. All right, I'm going to take a little bite of this guy.
Yeah, please do. Mm. It's just a real... I like to consider this a gateway to blue cheese. A lot of people, blue is just overwhelming. It's so strong and
subtle,
pungent. This is just sort of has the feel of our farm. It's like kind of earthy and easygoing. You know, it's an easygoing blue.
I was talking with my mouth full. No, go ahead.
I love when people try this cheese for the first time because you think you get a little bit of like mushroom on the front end, but then there's a sweetness at the finish, a little bit like white chocolate, which actually makes this cheese a wonderful dessert cheese. It's great with cherries, a little cherry jam, even a little bit of chocolate, a sweet wine, a stout is wonderful, a chocolate stout.
I have a tweet for you, Tanaya, from Eric. I'm talking with my mouth full. How about some opinions on beer versus wine as an accompaniment? I guess Tanaya goes beer, Wisconsin roots, New Glarus?
Oh, hey, Eric, New Glarus, for sure.
Love that beer.
You know, actually, I am a beer lover. I love effervescence with cheese because it allows you to eat more and not necessarily eat more, but feel kind of refreshed, have your palate refreshed between bites. If I'm at home, I'm either going to have a cocktail with cheese, Marty, or I'm going to have a beer. I love wine, too, but I feel like wine is much more challenging to pair with cheese. One is often stampeding over the other in terms of flavor. But with beer, I feel like you just get this, you get the effervescence, you get a lot of similar notes. You get, you know, beer has like butterscotch and molasses, things that you find in cheese. It also has herbs and fresh, bright, you know, I'm thinking like pilsners and wheat beers and things like that. You get these fresh, bright flavors that are terrific with like fresh, bright cheeses. There's nothing better than like putting out a cheese board and then telling your friends, bring some interesting beers and then just making a night of it.
Sue, you want to add something?
Yeah, it's really interesting to talk about the breweries because A, it's an easy way to get into it from a cost point. You know, to go out and select a bottle of wine, sometimes can be, you know, financially sure. a little bit more expensive to do. So the risk financially is pretty limited. But what I wanted to talk about is the brewers are really the cheesemaker's friends because we share a common eater, a common consumer, and they are leading. Sometimes when I have difficult questions on yeasts, I can talk to the brewers because their network is so strong. Often, I can't find a cheesemaker who can help me answer the mm-hmm. question, but a brewer knows the answer. So we like to kind of work with the breweries on many different levels, between the pairings, you know, cheese is a natural accompaniment at some of their little cafes, but also from a technical standpoint, they're really important to the cheesemaking community.
I'm curious to you, Stephanie, are you still experimenting? I mean, still working on developing new kinds of cheeses?
Constantly. And at this point, we are not so much adding new varieties, but trying to go deeper into the varieties that we are making and improving them constantly with flavor, with texture, with consistency. You know, trying to ride out the seasonal variations to sort of stabilize the cheese over the course of its life. I think the cheesemaker's work is never done, and that's why in Europe you have generations upon generations of information that has been passed down. I mean, Parmesan has been made for 800 years.
Wow.
It takes that long, you know. But that's what I was referring to, and I said it's a struggle every day. Milk is so finicky, you know, and especially grass-fed milk, like most of us use. It is different every day, not just the flavors, but the fat and the protein, depending on the lactation cycle of the animal, depending on the pasture that they're eating, and depending on the time of year, depending on the weather. So how do you, you know, sort of harness those variables to create a somewhat consistent product? That's a real challenge.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and our eating as well. And we've got some folks that want to join us. And that's Stephanie Angstad. She's owner and cheesemaker of Valley Milk House. That's in Berks County, Pennsylvania. Sue Miller with us as well, owner and cheesemaker of Bertram Hills Farm. That's in Chester County. And Tania Darlington is with us as well, and she's also known as Madame Fromage. 1-888-477-9499. That's a number to call to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking cheese and we are eating cheese. And I'm about to have another piece. This is a collaboration, Sue, between you and Stephanie. So what am I about to eat?
Well, this is a pretty fun cheese for us because it's a English style cloth-bound cheddar.
It's a chunky piece of
cheese,
I have to say.
It's a rugged mountain of a cheese right there. And this really grew out of Steph and I.
I'm doing this right?
Yeah, you're fine. You can't do anything wrong. I just would nip off the rind on that.
Okay.
I would just not consume the rind on that one. It's a little rugged.
Okay.
Yeah, so Steph and I, you know, we were together. I think we might have had a couple of beers.
Mm.
And we decided, let's make a cheese together. You know, it's kind of like we had this light go off. Let's do a collaborative cheese. And Steph had worked with a cheesemaker out in Colorado who did a cloth-bound cheddar. And we were discussing how she had won a blue ribbon with her cheese. I think that's what brought it up.
Right.
And I said, oh, I've never really made cheddar, never had an interest. It just was a cheese I swore I would never make. And we got laughing and we decided we'd make this cheddar together. We do it at my place with our milk. And it's so funny because, you know, here I am saying I'll never do a cheddar. And then Steph's aesthetic, as you can see, is these delicate little pristine French style cheeses. And we're going to go for the cheese that is mass produced and we're going to take it and remake it as our own.
You did, though.
Create it as our own.
You're the word person here.
Sure. Here's what's cool about
cheddar.
What
am I eating?
It's biscuity. A good cloth-bound cheddar should be like biscuit crumbly. And that's because they take the curds and they mill them as a kind of like running it through a sausage grinder, and they come out in little rice-sized pieces, and then they're pressed together
oh, wow.
into this cheese. So it has
really
it has a really unusual texture.
Mm-hmm. And again, also, a very subtle, subtle cheddar-y
taste. Mm-hmm. It's got a little tang. Mm-hmm. Sometimes cheddar can go a little grapefruit on you, you know, especially as it ages. It's pretty acidic. It's great with marmalades, great with IPAs. It likes other big, flashy flavors.
Right. And this type of cheese is really meant to be more on the savory side rather than an American cheddar, which is sweet and sharp. I think that to make it in the most easiest way to understand, it's more savory. It might be a little horseradish notes around the edge, which gets me super excited because one of my favorite English cheddars comes from Montgomery's Cheddar. And Tanaya and I had the great fortune to visit this production facility and meet the cheesemakers. And they're known for this kind of horseradish umami quality to the cheddar. Right. And then this is our first stab at it. So Steph and I were pretty excited doing it because we felt like we did a lot of things wrong that day in the vat.
And she's so
low,
right.
Yeah, she's so low key about it, and it's like it'll be what it'll be. And I'm like, yeah, but we have to cut the curd exactly now, and we missed our mark. And we had a great day that day, and we were just it was a long day, but we've done it again.
It was a labor of love,
definitely.
It really. Now I see why you. It's good to have the right equipment to be able to make this cheese.
So true.
And is there a little horseradish in here?
We don't add horseradish,
but it just
to
has
it.
Whatever.
There are horseradish cheddars out there, but you won't find us adding horseradish to ours. That's coming naturally from the aging process and from the milk. And you know, our cave has a certain character that really you'll find itself in your journey when you're eating our cheeses on the rind, and I think that really adds a lot to it.
Let me see what Jen from Haverford has to say. Jen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question regarding rennet. I am a vegetarian, and so as I've learned more and more about being a vegetarian and looking at labels, I've learned that rennet generally comes from an animal that has to have died in their gut, and I was just curious. Now that I look for microbial rennet or vegetarian rennet, you know, if your guests ever, you know, change up what kind of rennet they use.
Yeah. Who can do the rennet question? Everyone seems to be looking at you, Sue. Or you want to take it, Stephanie?
I can't either. Go ahead, Sue. Yeah.
So for us.
This is Sue.
For us, we do use animal rennet in our cheese making, and we do it because it's a traditional method for the styles of cheese that we're creating. And so to kind of give that sense of tradition, it's due with how we're feeding our cows, how we're handling the milk, how we're making the cheese. I felt really strongly that I wanted to continue with that traditional practice by using the animal rennet. We have used some vegetable rennet in the past, but as I investigated some of the attributes of the vegetable rennet is that they are so very highly, highly processed to come to that. It's you know, kind of a bastardization of the original product when you end up with the vegetable rennet. And for me, I just thought, I'm going to go with the traditional methodology. I don't know how you feel about it, Steph. I would say that you're on
it's,
the same continuum.
You know, it's such a hot-button issue, Jen. Right. You're certainly not the first one to ask. We get asked this probably at every farmer's market. And I sort of wish that more folks would ask about the welfare of the animals, rather than whether their life ended, because it's a farm and at some point all of the animals' lives will end. And you know, veal or calf rennet, you know, that's all very much part of a dairy farm. I mean, you can't unfortunately milk male cows. And so this is all just a byproduct. And I think to look more holistically and cyclically at how a farm runs would help encourage, you know, a broader perspective on the types of rennet available. Having said that, we did make the switch to microbial rennet because we did end up losing a lot of customers to this issue, and we do want to be as inclusive as possible, but it's still an issue that I really like talking about.
Fair enough. Jen, thanks for the call. Let me see what Bonnie from Mount Airy has to say. And Bonnie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the executive chef at Weaver Toy Cup, and I think a number of your guests are friends with my cheesemonger there.
Yeah.
His name is Matt Gudenstein. And my comments, well, I have two comments. We used to have on our menu in our a domestic cheese tray that we did on our catering menu and an imported one. we recently changed our menu to just artisanal cheeses because, as you commented, there are so many great cheeses being made locally that we started to substitute those with some of the imported cheeses.
That's good
and
to know.
My other comment was that I think it's just so wonderful that there's an area where women are having the opportunity to excel in the culinary field in a way that in some ways is not always as accessible. So those are my comments.
Sure.
And I thank you for all the work you guys are doing.
Thank you. Well, Bonnie, thanks for calling in. Tanai, you want to respond to that at all?
Well,
is it unusual to have three women talking about cheese and cheese making?
I don't know. I mean, there are certainly male cheesemakers in this area, and when we go to the American Cheese Society conference, it feels like, I don't know, would you two say that it's a pretty even split? Maybe it's more like two-thirds women, one-third. But if you take the farms into consideration as to like who the herd managers are and things like that, I don't know. I feel like maybe it's kind of an even split. What do you think?
I feel an even split.
I think so, yeah. I think it's about the same.
But I would say the pioneers in American cheese making have been women. People like Alison Hooper in Vermont, the people at Cypress Grove,
maybe Mary Keene.
Mary Keene. There are a lot of
Peggy Conley. Yeah.
Interesting.
Right. These
or
are
Peggy
folks
Smith, Sue Conley.
Who started with one or two animals, often for 4-H with their kids, got into cheese making, started to sell to markets and then to restaurants. So.
An email from Fred. Is it okay to eat the rind and even when it's white or other colors? And I heard a gasp. Was that from you, Sue?
Oh, my gosh. It is so all right to eat the rind.
That's
we encourage
thought.
It because, you know, and I think that Tanai and Steph would agree with me. It's part of the journey of the cheese. I always take a little taste of the rind. The times where I don't is if there is a very strong ammoniated flavor, I'll ease off of it. So that's a guide, mm-hmm. I would say. But
Wax.
But
I would
right.
say,
I never, that doesn't even exist in my world.
But. I see at so many parties, people digging into the brie to not eat the white, fluffy goodness on the outside. And I always feel like, well, they have just done me a huge service because
and
I always
get
love
the
rind. The rind usually has the most flavor. And like on a brie, you'll get like a nice peppery note on the rind, whereas the paste is buttery. I see that Marty's about to
dump
dive
into
in.
The brie here since you mentioned that.
Yeah, Steph has this beautiful.
This is your brie, Steph?
Yes, that one
right,
we call thistle.
Oh, thistle.
That is made from pasteurized cow's milk, and it's aged for about 6 weeks, that one there. And we've made sure to bring that one to room temperature so that you get the nice texture and the full flavor. But, you know, we go through so much effort to develop rinds. Our lives would be easier if we vacuum sealed everything. So please eat the rind. Please we work so hard at making sure that it looks and tastes just right.
Excuse me, my mouth is full. I'm eating these on corn cakes.
Yeah.
But what about the cracker? I mean,
okay, I'll tell you why I brought these corn cakes.
And
I'm
tasting, you did. I'm tasting corn cakes.
Sure. Well, I think they're not, the world is full of cheese, and I'm looking for the cracker world to step up to the plate because I think sometimes crackers compete. But this particular company, which comes out of Massachusetts, run by two women, I think they do a great line of crackers that are designed to support cheese. And I just like that little bit of crunch, especially with these soft cheeses. Otherwise, if you hang out with other cheese people, there's like usually no bread, no crackers. Everyone is just eating the cheese, you know, naked cheese. Cheese people tend
nothing
to be purists.
Wrong with that.
But I think if you're going to do a pairing, if you're going to add jam, which I love, or honey, it's nice to have like a little raft under your dairy.
Yeah. Do you care what your cheese is put on, Stephanie?
Oh, yeah. I think it definitely matters. And I try to stay away from, I mean, I think what Tanai is bringing is a nice subtle aroma. But anything with too much, you know, garlic or flavoring would definitely be overpowering.
Let me get another caller. This is, I just had to gulp there, David from Flemington. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks, Marty. It seemed like in the late 70s, early 80s, the whole country was a big bubbling fondue pot. People's homes and restaurants and, you know, beer and wonderful bread. And I just remember going all kinds of places. And I just wanted to know, was it just kind of a passing thing?
Is fondue, I mean, trends come and go tonight.
Hey, Marty, I'm half Swiss, so I'm always fun doing it. Yeah, in fact, there was just a big event in New York at one of the importers' storage facilities called the Fondue. And cheesemongers from all over the East Coast came in with their best fondue recipe, and guests could, you know, vote on their favorite fondue.
When I got married, which actually I realized 43 years ago today.
Wow. Congratulations.
I think we got five fondue dishes. So
true.
I'm not sure we ever used any of them. Let me see what Anne from Princeton has to say. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Anne.
Yes. Hi. What do you do with old cheese? Two quick questions. I go to a friend of mine for party. I'm French, so she gets me all the good cheese in the world. I'm happy. And then I go back 6 months later, and the brie has dried up, and everything else has dried up. Beside grating, what can you do with that? I have another quick question about old ricotta cheese, too.
Oh, old ricotta cheese. Well, I'm looking at you, Stephanie. What do we do with old cheeses?
Well, okay, I'm going to deflect this question in a moment. I think Sue and Tanaya might have good ideas about recipes for old cheese, but I think to avoid the problem in the first place is a good idea. And that's why, you know, farmers markets are so great and all the cheese shops that we have around the city. You know, it is so nice to get cheese, as Tanaya was saying, at its peak optimal flavor. Once it's old and dried out, it's not really going to be a pleasurable experience. But
so
maybe,
eat it, you're saying. You know, don't let
sooner.
It like, sit around.
But, Tanaya, maybe you have ideas.
I'll tell you, the cheesemongers at De Bruyne Brothers, specifically Hunter Fike, once looked me in the eye and said, never throw away good cheese. It can always be used. And he taught me to make fromage four, which is what the French do. And you simply take your cheese. You know, if it's got a lot of like exterior mold that's grown on it, I usually just shave that off with the paring knife. But then I'll grate the cheese with several cloves of garlic, add a little brandy and a little white wine, stir it all together, put it in a pot, and
what do you have?
Kind of let it macerate. What's that?
So you and then put that on a cracker?
Actually, then you let it sit for a bit. So you put it on a, I'll do it like in a little clay pot with a lid. And honestly, I just leave it on the windowsill for about 3 days. It is strong as heck when you take the lid off. Wow. But it's delicious. You can spread it on bread, melt it, put it under the broiler. It's terrific. Rather than having like buying a cheese spread, that's like my home, my in-home cheese spread.
Anything you want to add to that?
Well, that's exactly where I was going to go, the fromage fort. And, you know, there's a lot of blogs out there in the blogosphere on this. Smitten Kitchen has a great one in case the caller would like to look it up.
Smitten Kitchen. And she had a question about old ricotta, but I don't know if we can deal with
that. You could probably grate old ricotta.
Yeah, ricotta salata.
If it still smells good, you know, if it hasn't spoiled,
right.
You could dry it and grate it.
So there is, you two are the Rennet, who's the Rennet Rough Riders? Are you all Rennet Rough Riders?
We're just, all members.
You're all Rennet.
Card carrying
So when
members.
Cheese people get together, not on the radio, what do they talk about?
We talk about cheese.
It's a Philadelphia cheese club that we spontaneously started one evening when there are so many awesome cheese lovers in the city, cheesemakers, cheesemongers. There's a local cheese painter, Mike Gino. We were all sitting around one night and we said we should have like a motorcycle gang, but for cheese people, and we should get satin jackets that say Rennet Rough Riders on the back. So every now and then, now it's a hashtag we use on Instagram, and we'll text each other and say, hey, let's have a Rennet Rough Riders meetup tonight and go out for a beer.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times, and special thanks for bringing in this fabulous cheese or cheeses for all of us. I will be sharing after the show is over. Tanaya Darlington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Stephanie Angstad, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us.
And Sue Miller, thank you for coming in and talking about and bringing us cheese as well.
Oh, it was fantastic.
Fantastic for us as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including some pictures I'm sure we have posted on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moss Cloain, and we couldn't resist this. This is Monty Python's Cheese Shop Sketch.
Now, my good man, some cheese, please.
Yes, certainly, sir. What would you like?
Well, how about a little Red Leicester?
I'm afraid we're fresh out of Red Leicester, sir.
Never mind. How are you on Tilsit?
Never at the end of the week, sir. Always get it fresh first thing on Monday.
Tish, tish. No matter. Well, 4 ounces of kefili then, if you please, stout yeoman.
Ah, well, it's been on order for 2 weeks, sir. I was expecting it this morning.
Yes, it's not my day, is it? Belpaese?
Sorry.
Red Windsor?
Normally, sir, yes. But today the van broke down.
Ah. Stilton?
Sorry.
Gruyere, Emmental?
No.
Any Norwegian Jarlsberger?
No.
Liptauer?
No.
Lancashire?
No.
White Stilton?
No.
Danish Blue?
No.
Double Gloucester?
No.
Cheshire?
No.
Any Dorset Blue Vinny?
No.
Brie, Roquefort, Pont l'Evêque, Port Salut, Savoy, Saint Paul, Carré de l'Est, Boursin, Brest Bleu, Perle de Champagne.